everybody. Thibault?
Okay, thank you. So I would report about some work done recently with Mark Eno and Herman Nicolai. And I will explain all what this means, even for people not never heard of hyperbolic Kac-Moody algebras, like me some 2 years ago. So, so first, some historical remarks. It was a big surprise when in 1978, Cremer and Julliard, by studying the symmetries of the four-dimensional reductions of the 11-dimensional supergravity Lagrangians, discovered the hidden E7 symmetry, where E is the finite Lie group, exceptional Lie group in the Cartan classification. And they conjectured at the time that there would be neighboring E6 and E7, I mean E6 and E8 in three space-time dimensions. Then later, Julia went on to conjecture that the more you go down in dimension, the higher this symmetry of the Kaluza-Klein reduced theory augments, and that it would be a fine version of E8 called E9 in two space-time dimensions. And he even went beyond that, saying that maybe one can make sense of reducing the supergravity Lagrangian to one dimension, and then there might be something which would be the hyperbolic version of E8, which is E10 that I will be talking about. And for many years, this E10 structure was mysterious, because if you reduce supergravity really to one dimension, you just have ODEs. I mean, you have no space dependence, only time dependence. And then, in fact, you lose completely all the symmetry structure of E7, E8, which are based on duality relations and things like that. But the main theme of the talk today will be that we found evidence for E10 by going to a limit of studying the supergravity Lagrangians. In fact, I will really talk about the bosonic sectors of all superstring theories or M theory. We will discuss the case of heterotic string, for instance, which is different from E10 later. That in a cosmological setting, when you look at generic solutions which have a Big Bang singularity, these solutions mainly depend on one variable, which is time. But when you keep taking into account that you look at the generic solution, which is inhomogeneous with all space gradients, you both have the fact that it's nearly one-dimensional, but that you keep all the space gradients which allow to do this kind of dualities. And because of that, we found evidence of E10 in a generic cosmological type of solutions of this Lagrangian. I should also mention that our work was certainly not the... Ah, yes. First, let me mention a very important point, is that I will be talking about a continuous symmetry E10 of R. So it's an infinite dimensional Lie group for real parameters. This is a symmetry in the sense of the, like the GR generating solutions, in the sense that it transforms the solution of the theory in another solution, a physically different solution in general. You expect that in string theory, the real version will be a discrete version like E10 of Z, and which will be just evidently much smaller than E10 of R, and that this will be a symmetry which transforms a state in a physically equivalent state. That's not what I will be talking about, just to clarify, although the algebra is the same. So what we will find is the algebra of E10, its generators, its representations, but we'll be working only with the low energy structure. I should also mention that hyperbolic Kac-Moody algebras of the type of E10 have been also detected by several other means in string theory, like the spectrum of BPS states, also by studying the U-duality group, and especially its Weil group by people like Oberst, Piolin, Bank, Fischler, Mottl. Okay. So first, a small reminder about what happens for GR, pure Einstein, that is to say Ricci equals zero, in 3+1 dimensions, because what we found is in fact a generalization of this. And after the fact, you realize that what we discovered, I mean the E10, I mean the conjecture detail we have makes another conjecture for pure GR, so that people only interested in pure GR in 3 plus 1 dimension, one discovers that there is also an interesting hyperbolic Kathmoody algebra called AE3, which is the hyperbolic extension of SU2. So it's like the simplest hyperbolic Kathmoody algebra. You start from the simplest finite Kathmoody algebra, SU2, then you extend it, rank by 2, you make it affine and then hyperbolic, and then this is a structure which appears in GR in 3 plus 1. But I will be mainly talking about 11 dimension later. But historical remarks. So in the 70s, Belinsky, Halatnikov, and Lifshitz discovered that the generic solution of Einstein's equations having a Big Bang type or Big Crunch type singularity at t equals 0 had a very complicated structure. The structure was such that if at a fixed point of space x you go towards the singularity, t going to 0 this way, in this limiting process, you find that the geometry of space-time undergoes an infinite number of what they call oscillations, that is to say locally during a small patch, the geometry looks like a power law solution, so-called Kasner, that I will remind you of. But then this Kasner solution is unstable, so it jumps from one Kasner to another Kasner, and there is an infinite number of jumps, each one taking a smaller and smaller time steps, okay? And then they analyze this. So this is a discovery which concerns the generic solution, the most general solution depending on all coordinates in time and space, but it could be analyzed also in simpler homogeneous frameworks like the so-called type 9 Bianchi spaces, which was studied at the same time by BKL and Misner. But really the important result is for the fully inhomogeneous one. Then a big surprise also came in 1985, is that if you look at the books of Landau-Lifshitz and the papers of BKL, they say that they have checked that their oscillatory behavior takes place for GR in 3 plus 1 dimension and GR in 4 plus 1 dimension. And then by continuity, evidently, they expected it would be true for all dimensions. But Desmarais, Hainaut, and Spandel in 1985 found there was something in special in 11 dimension, which is that this chaotic behavior stops. It no longer happens in 11, 12, 13 dimensions. So 11 dimension is special. But this is for pure Ricci equals 0. What we will find is that if you add all the Ramon-Ramon fields, or the three form in 11 dimensions directly, then the BKL chaos is re-established, in fact. So this discovery is still mathematically there, but physically it has not the same meaning. Let us also mention that in any number of dimensions, if you consider Einstein equations coupled to a scalar field, then you don't have this infinite number of oscillations, you have a much more mild behavior, which is power law all the way towards C equals 0. So what are we going to talk about? So we talk about the massless bosonic degrees of freedom at the two derivative effective action level for all superstring models. So which means that when you write them explicitly, their field content looks different, like in 2a or 2b. You always have the metric and the dilatant for all string theories in 10 dimensions, but either you have only the Neuve-Schwarz BMU, or you have Ramon-Ramon fields with also two indices for type 2b or 3 here, etc. You know all that. We will also consider evidently type 1, heterotic, and M. And we analyze all those, and then we are discussing first about the leading behavior of the cosmological Big Crunch type singularities for all those models at the classical level as they are, which means that you consider a generic Lagrangian in capital D space-time dimensions with an Einstein term, with when you are in 10 dimension, you always have the dilaton as an extra scalar excitation, and then this dilaton is coupled to p-form fields with exponential couplings, and then you have many other couplings of Chern-Simon types. So what will happen is that in the first part of the talk, where we'll talk about the leading behavior for the cosmological solution, these couplings are not important, but in the second part, where you really try to find this Eaton structure, all those couplings and all the coefficients of the term Simons, the value of the numerical coefficients of all the term Simons times coupling, for instance for the three form, are essential and will be matched to structure coefficients of the E10 algebra. And this is in fact part of the evidence that there is really an E10 algebra, that we can match the, all those famous term Simons terms there. But in the first part, what will be important is that you have Einstein, in this Einstein frame, a dilaton, and p-forms coupled to the dilaton. Now, if you open Landau-Lifschitz to see how is traditionally done the BKL, so Belinsky-Raratnikov-Lifschitz analysis, this is done usually at the level of the equations of motion. And so the equations of motion, they look like Ricci equal the term coming from the scalar field, then plus many terms coming from the p-forms. You have the equations for the scalar field, which is coupled to the p-forms, so you have source terms here. And first you look for simple power law solutions of these equations where you forget about the ellipses, and then you plug back this solution to see if it is stable or not, and that's what you start the discussion. So just to remind you of what is the notation, let's say. A Kasner solution means a power law solution for the metric, which in the proper time gauge dt square would mean that the metric coefficients, apart from the fact that you allow for the frame to be x dependent, means essentially that each proper direction of space has a scale factor which varies like a power t to the power pi. So you have one exponent pi per space dimension, but you have also an exponent p for the dilaton, for the scalar, because as we know well, it's exponential phi, which is like a metric component. So the coefficient of log of t in phi plays the role of an exponent p phi at the same level as the space exponents pi. So finally, the number of exponents you have is you have as many here as in space. So if you are in a string theory, you have 9 space dimension plus the dilaton, so it means 10. You have 10 of these exponents, and they must satisfy, if you plug this thing in these equations, both a quadratic constraint, which says that some quadratic form which has a signature plus 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 minus, it has an hyperbolic signature, is equal to zero, and then a linear constraint. The fact that this signature has the Lorentzian signature evidently comes from the fact that the minus sign is the famous conformal mode of Einstein equation, which is always the wrong sign. But this is this Lorentzian structure which will give the Lorentzian structure of the Katz-Moody algebra, which we'll enter later. Now, in fact, a better way of analyzing the system is not to look at the field equations, but to look at the Hamiltonian. So the Hamiltonian formulation is that you write for each field, let's say for the metric as a conjugate momentum pi ij, the dilaton as a conjugate pi phi, the p-form components a, i1, ip as a conjugate momentum, which is in fact the electric field, but it's the momenta pi a. And then you have the Hamiltonian, which is given by a combination of the Hamiltonian constraints and the momentum constraints. We will work in a zero shift gauge, and we don't need to examine what happens with the Hamiltonian, with the momentum constraints here. The essential is the Hamiltonian constraints, which then contains kinetic terms for the gravity, kinetic terms for phi, kinetic terms for the p-forms, which are essentially the electric energy E square, and then all the rest is potential energy, and this by definition, and potential energy contains the space curvature from the Einstein. So now it's small d, where d is the space dimension, so it will, small d will be 10 when I'm in 11 dimension, plus the gradient of phi, plus the magnetic energy of all the p-form fields. Plus, by the way, when there are Chern Simon terms, there are more complicated couplings between the velocity and momenta. All that has to be taken into account. But now, to do a nice reduction, what you can do is first change variables. The metric, which is a symmetric matrix, is represented by an Iwasawa decomposition in terms of its diagonal part. And you denote the diagonal part of the metric by an exponential notation. So exponential minus 2 beta 1 would be the first component of the metric in Iwasawa decomposition, which means that this part of the metric here is an upper triangular matrix here. this turns out to be extremely convenient technically. So the metric is represented now instead of Gij in terms of the beta and in terms of these n's and their conjugate momenta. Now, how many betas in all do we have? We have as many betas as diagonal components of the metric, but we have also an extra beta for the dilaton phi when we are in string theory. Or if we are in 11-dimensional supergravity, we immediately have 10 space dimensions, and therefore we have 10 betas, which, by the way, although, they will be denoted with an index mu because they will come with a Lorentzian structure. That's why it is mu. Now, the structure of the Hamiltonian is indicated here. It's repeated here. The Hamiltonian has a first term, which are the kinetic terms of the betas. So the pi betas are the conjugate momenta to, therefore, the diagonal components of the metric, which says that locally the metric looks like a kind of box which is squeezed in certain directions and maybe expanding in certain directions. These directions being like more or less eigen expansions directions of the metric, although it's the Ivazawa decomposition which fixes really these things. So we have these 10 kinetic terms, where the metric G mu nu which enters here is just the metric which will be written on the next transparencies, and it's essentially minus plus 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 plus. It's a Lorentzian metric without field dependence. And then you have all the rest. But what is nice is that all the rest is organized in some exponential factors of the betas, of linear combination of the betas. These exponential factors come simply from the fact that when you compute like the curvature or any electric or magnetic field energy, you make products of the metric components G, but each metric component is parameterized as E exponential minus beta. So combination of metric components gives exponential of sums of betas, and therefore you have linear forms in the betas. The appearance of many linear forms here will be essential because this is in these linear forms that we will recognize all the structure of the Kac-Moody algebras, in fact, later. And the fact that we get an infinite number of linear forms is linked to the fact that the algebra is infinite dimensional. And now the rest of the structure are very complicated coefficients that depend on all the other degrees of freedom of the thing, like the off-diagonal metric and their momenta and all the key forms. So you would think that I have achieved absolutely nothing at this stage. But in fact, one can prove very easily something which goes beyond, in fact, what was proven by BKL, which is that all those degrees of freedom, they freeze as you go towards the Big Bang. As you go towards t equals zero, you find that all these off-diagonal degrees of freedom, they start behaving chaotically during the oscillations, but after a while, these chaotic oscillations are smaller and smaller, and they have a limit, finite limit for all of them at t going to zero, which is log of t going to infinity in this direction. The only really chaotic dynamics concerns the diagonal, the 10 diagonal components of the metric, the betas, and these will have complicated behavior, which will be described in the following. Now, because of the result that you prove that all other degrees of freedom freeze to some values, the dynamics is equivalent to a simple dynamics for a particle. This particle is the beta particle, so this particle represents just the diagonal components of the metric. It has a kinetic term which is quadratic, and now which is given explicitly, for instance, for 11-dimensional supergravity, this quadratic form is given by this thing, but this is a Lorentzian metric in 11 dimension. And then it has a potential term, which is made of all those complicated things coming from the off-diagonal degrees of freedom. If you want, roughly speaking, taking account these off-diagonal degrees of freedom is just like saying if I have a particle, if I factor out the conserved angular momentum, then I get centrifugal forces for the radial part of the motion, which depends on the square of the angular momentum. So all these are like square of angular momentums in front of powers of the exponential betas, I mean products of exponential betas, which means linear forms of the betas. But at this stage, you recognize that you have like a TODA model, in the sense that you have a complicated system in which you have those 10 variables with a Lorentzian thing. And here, this potential is a sum of exponential potentials. That is, each potential is an exponential of a linear form in the betas. And for the leading terms, we will find that all of those coefficients in front are positive, which means that all those potentials are repulsive walls. I will draw a figure in a moment. So in general, for instance, for Suga, you have 700 of these walls here, which means that, for instance, among the combinations of variables you have these combinations, which describe a term in this Hamiltonian, which comes from the Einstein R. I mean, among one of the terms of the dynamics was evidently to have the Einstein curvature. This Einstein curvature give a wall which is proportional to exponential minus this type of combinations. But among other terms, you have evidently the p-form terms, which have electric energy and magnetic energy. The electric energy gives a term which is exponential minus 2 times the sum of 3 betas. And the fact that you have the sum of 3 betas, in fact, is directly linked to the fact that you have the 3-form, in fact. Because when you take the square of the electric energy of a 3-form, you need 3 metrics to make an invariant out of it. And as the metric was parametrized as exponential minus 2 beta, it means exponential minus 2 beta 1 plus beta 2 plus beta 3, let's say, for the part of the electric field flux, which is in the 1, 2, 3 hyperplane, if you want. For magnetic things, you have more complicated, you have 6, and then you have symmetry walls, which comes from the Ivazawa decomposition. So I hope you have some idea of the kind of dynamics you have. So now, in the space of the betas are surrounded by many of these exponential walls, which are positive like that. But that means that an exponential wall, you can qualitatively understand what happens. Most of the time, an exponential wall can be taken to be zero and then to be nearly infinite. So when the particle is far away in the middle, the wall is like nothing, and then it reflects here and then it goes back. Which means also that although there are 700 walls, you have to take into account only of the first wall that you encounter. It's like in this room, if you are a fly and you go around, it's only the first wall you encounter, not the wall on the next floor up there. I mean, the wall exists and non-locally has some influence, but in leading approximation, you don't see it. So you can simplify the dynamics first. After that, we will complicate it back. But the leading approximation is to ask, what are the walls that you encounter first? And this is where the analysis simplifies very much. You find that in all cases, for all string theories, you encounter only 10 walls. And these walls are very simple, but they are not the same for various string theories. Like, for instance, if you are in M theory or type 2, the walls are given by these ones. If you are in heterotic or type 1, you prove that the walls are equivalent to each other, but they are not the same as when you have two supersymmetries. And these walls will be identical, I mean, turn out to be identical to Weyl chamber of Katz-Moody algebras. So let me, so in a word, the dynamics we find will be the following. The leading order dynamics of the geometry is described by an equivalent particle beta, which is in a Lorentzian space, and this particle in between two encounters with the walls, it goes straight with a kinetic energy beta dot square. So it's like a massless particle, a photon which goes straight. But from time to time, it encounters a wall on which it reflects, but reflects really like a photon reflects on a mirror. You know, it's a geometric reflection, which means also that the dynamics of what happens near the singularity is encoded in a sequence of reflections in hyperplanes. And now, when you realize that if you want to encode what is the structure of this billiard dynamics, you need to encode what is the geometry of the group of reflections in walls like that. And this is precisely encoded in the notion of Coxeter Dinking diagram, which enters universally in mathematics to classify many things, because it is a universal way of classifying angles between hyperplanes and things like that. So, a reminder for people. We all know that in the case of SU2, the Lie algebra is conveniently decomposed into the operator JZ, and then the raising and lowering operator J plus and J minus, and that they satisfy this simple type relation. Now, the Katz-Moody algebra is a generalization of this, in which instead of having one JZ, you have a certain number of self-commuting analog of JZ, which are the so-called Cartan subalgebra. So the number of these defines the rank of the algebra. So we will, E10 means there are 10 such now commuting JZ. And then you have raising and lowering operators. the raising are called, let's say, E alpha S, and they are labeled by an index alpha, which is called root, which is a linear form on the Cartan subalgebra, that is to say the space of the JZs here. And therefore, you label these by these linear forms. And then from these linear forms, alpha associated to a set of simple roots, you find that general roots can be decomposed in integer sums of so-called simple roots. Then you make the so-called Cartan matrix. Okay. For the case of SU3, for instance, you have a diagram of roots, which is the famous hexagon. Simple roots would be alpha 1 and alpha 2. Now, we will be talking about hyperbolic Kathmodi algebras, where the root diagram is not in an Euclidean space, but in a Lorentzian space. So I have a time direction and space direction. And they will have a structure like that. There will be a light cone. The roots which are outside the light cone have the square of their length, which is positive, so they correspond to the usual roots of the usual Cartan algebras. And all the other roots will have a square length, which is either 0 or negative, minus 2, minus 4, and things like that. And by the way, the simplest algebra I was talking about, which is relevant for GR in 3 plus 1 dimension, is given by this decaying diagram corresponding to this thing. And this is what was behind the DKL thing. But now, we had found before that the generic behavior of M-theory or type 2 theories, neo-cosmological singularity, is described by 10 walls. When you compute what is the structure of these 10 walls, you find that they are described by this diagram, Dinking diagram, which encodes what is the angles between these walls only. And this diagram is called the one, it defines E10. Okay, so this was the first trace of E10. But at this stage, what we have here is just the Weyl group of E10. Because the Weyl group is the group of reflections in the fundamental walls of E10, and it is a coarse description of the dynamics. Now we are going to go beyond the Weyl group. So now, but what is interesting is heterotic or type 1 does not have the same hyperbolic Kathmodi algebra, or at least the Weyl group at this stage, but you have something related which is called BE10, which is also rank 10, which has this structure here, but here there is something special. And I won't spend the time to talk about the fact that DE10 also might appear. And by the way, there are only 3 possibilities in rank 10, and this is the highest rank in which you have this thing, simplex type of diagrams. So 10 is really special. E11 has nothing of the nice features of E10. I mean, somebody like Peter West has been mentioning E11, but we find no trace of E11. So to summarize qualitatively the dynamics of the longitudinal degrees of freedom, the diagonal degrees of freedom of the metric, are equivalent to a particle in the 10-dimensional Lorentz space, which is surrounded by 10 walls, and roughly these walls have this structure. I mean, they do not confine the motion towards future infinity, because going towards future infinity means essentially, as I have parameterized the metric G pi exponential minus 2 beta, means that the metric components shrink to 0, so it means collapse. So going towards t equals 0, going to small metric, G going to 0, is equivalent to going to plus infinity there. But you go there onwards on the light cone, but you are deflected from the light cone by all those walls. And the first thing that was not totally evident when we started working on it is to prove that these walls confine you, that is to say. Because a priori, there could be open walls, open space between the walls. You could go to infinity. If two of these walls did not meet on the light cone here, but at left an angle here, which is represented here, okay, these walls could have been like that after projection. Here I'm projecting from the hyperbolic space, from the Lorentzian space to the hyperbolic space on the unit hyperbole, let's say. So there could have been a situation like that, which would have meant that the generic solution was not chaotic, but after a finite number of oscillations on the walls, would go straight in this direction. The fact that this is closed off means you always have an infinite number of oscillations, you always go around like that an infinite number of times. So at this stage, one gets something which looked like chaos. But what is interesting is that this chaos should not be thought as an orderless structure, but on the contrary, this chaos is linked to something apparently to an extreme symmetry, which is E10. And this is now what I want to describe in some detail. By attacking, so all we did before was done in the leading approximation, where we said in leading approximation, only the diagonal degrees of freedom matter. All the other degrees of freedom were frozen in the limit, and then we could concentrate on this. They are frozen, but they are still there. I mean, they still move a little bit. And now if you ask a question about the symmetry, you want to keep all degrees of freedom and make an expansion. But what happens is our method gives a way of making successive approximation. The leading approximation is to say we make this billiard approximation, where this is a good description with constants in front. And this, in the Katz-Moody language, corresponds to taking combination of the roots of height 1. That is to say, you find finally that the notion of dominant wall, where the so-called height 1, where the simple roots, okay? Because any root is like, if I call simple roots alpha 1, alpha 2, any root will be like 2 alpha 1 plus 3 alpha 2 plus etc. And therefore exponential minus 2 alpha 1 plus 3 alpha 2 is always smaller than exponential minus alpha 1 or exponential minus alpha 2. So the first walls are always encounter alpha 1, alpha 2, and the other walls are behind. But now we want to say, if there is really E10, we must keep all walls behind the leading wall and discover that when I expand in the number of walls beyond the first wall, it matches something which is E10 invariant. And this is where the notion of height and something which is valid up to height 30, because what we are going to show is that up to an expansion where we keep 30 combinations of simple walls, it works. There is an absolute precise match between E10 and the supergravity Lagrangian. After that, it gets more complicated and we don't have results yet. So I explained that. This is the root diagram of E10. The simple roots, by the way, are always space-like. They make like a necklace here around this at alpha squared equal plus 2 level. Okay. But now we are going to include roots which are more complicated, both outside and null roots, and we don't have really results about negative roots yet, although we go up to height 30. I will explain this. And yes, a word also, heuristically, what are we doing? The reason why there is some simplification when you go towards a space-like singularity is basically because two points of space causally separate, and therefore it makes sense to say that locally the dynamics should depend only on time, and because waves do not have the time to propagate. The hyperbolic structure gets broken when you go towards C equals zero. So in a sense, intuitively, we work as if the velocity of light C was going to zero, let's say, as if we are in a medium in which light does not have the time to propagate, interaction do not have to propagate. But as for any medium, we can write the velocity of propagation as square root of the tension, the bulk tension of the medium divided by the matter density of the tension of the medium. We can say that formally we are in a limit where the bulk tension of space, which allows gravitational waves and p-forms to propagate, tends to zero. And as formally the bulk tension, which is in fact it's given by Newton's constant, so we are in a limit where c4 over g tends to zero, okay, which might be related to a limit where the string tension goes to zero. A limit which has been, which means, no, string tension goes, yeah, to zero, which means alpha prime going to infinity, which is the limit in which David Gross had found long ago that there was an infinite number of relations between string amplitudes. So we don't know, there are other suggestions that these type of limits are interesting. Anyway, what we do is really this limit, but now let's go beyond the leading term in this limit and include more and more terms. To do this, we need to have a mathematical understanding of E10, and this was, although E10 is defined in the literature, in fact we needed to construct explicitly the algebra in a new way. To do that, you realize that E10 can be constructed in the following way. You start from a GL10 subalgebra, so it means you start from generators of affine rotations in 10 dimensions, K, let's say. Then this corresponds to all those generators. Yes, I should say this is the E10 diagram. All those roots here define the GL10 subalgebra. Now you start adding this root here. This root corresponds to adding a generator, which is a new generator with three indices and which is antisymmetric in three indices. Evidently, this object will be immediately linked to the three form later. But the fact that this is a three form means because it is the third node in the E10 diagram. Okay? So you add this, and then you generate an algebra by saying, I start with that, and then I make commutators of my thing. So if I commute this and this, I fall back on this. But if I commute 2e with 3 indices, I will start getting indices with 6 indices, objects with 6 indices. So you generate more and more generators of your Lie algebra, and we could compute up to a very high level. I mean, there is a paper of a student of Nicolai which goes to level 100 of, if you want to see. There are millions of these representations. But we did all that by hand. What I will report was done by hand. After that, it's too complicated to be done by hand. So you can explicitly write what is the, maybe we postpone questions to the end, no, not like that. Because I want to state very clearly what we have proven about E10. We have not proven much in a sense, but still we have proven something which is not trivial. Okay. What we do is we construct a coset model based on E10, that is to say a G over H coset model. You know that for any group G, if H is the maximally compact subgroup, then you can write, this is an homogeneous space, and then you can write a simple model which is invariant under the full G group, but which is based on G over H. Here you can define in the same way what is the maximally compact subgroup of E10, although it's an infinite group. It has a well-defined real form, and it is defined by its representation. We work directly in a real representation of the thing. So what you do, so let me define the coset model. You take an arbitrary element in the group, okay? So you write it as an exponential of an element in the Lie algebra. The Lie algebra you decompose in all its generators. Now you make an Iwasawa decomposition of it in order to be able to separate the part of the algebra which will be the part that you project out, that is to say the H part. So it's like taking a general matrix and then decomposing it in its symmetric part and in anti-symmetric part. You take out the SON part of the matrix, if you want. So you do the same thing. This Lie algebra, from the group element capital G, you define a velocity vector small v, which is v minus 1 v dot, which should be written somewhere. It's not written, but it's v dot v minus 1, which is called small v. You project it. You project out its by its adjoint, which is defined by the Chevalet transpose, and then you take the square of it because you have the notion of square. You have all the notions you need, like in ordinary Lie algebra, which is trace of v square exists in this framework because Victor Katz has shown they exist, so we can use them. And now you compute explicitly what it is. So this is an E10 calculation. You have the group elements are parametrized for the level 0 for the GL10 generators by a matrix which has no symmetry. Then, as I said, there is a generator which has 3 antisymmetric indices. Therefore, it comes with a field component which has the also 3 antisymmetric indices in the opposite ring. Then I have 6 antisymmetric indices. Then I have something with 9 indices which is neither symmetric nor antisymmetric. And this is where we will stop the calculation. The full E10 element will go to infinity, but we could check that this will match with supergravity, so it's already something. You plug this in the explicitly E10 invariant coset model. By the way, when I say coset model, this was a one-dimensional coset model. Because we could write a two-dimensional coset model, but we write something which depends on only one variable, t, it's enough for our purposes. Then you plug this and that in the model, then you find this Lagrangian. And now, with a precise structure, you have like kinetic terms, evidently, but you have mixed terms between the 3 form multiplied by the 3 form, which mixes with the 6 form. Here you have 3 plus 6, which goes with 9, and 3, 3, 3, which goes with 9. All those coefficients, 42 minus 42, 280, are predicted uniquely by the group structure of E10, and they will match the supergravity Lagrangian. But now, how do you match? Now it's a question of correspondence. We are saying, here is an E10 invariant thing. How do we prove there is a map between the two? We prove it by brute force. That's why we were limited at some stage. So this is the Kremer-Julia-Scherk Lagrangian. Now this is an 11-dimensional thing, why I had a one-dimensional thing here. But what we do is we analyze this Lagrangian around the point x in space, and we will express the geometry in terms of successive space gradients of the geometry and the three form around this point. Like there will be the value of the three form on this point, of the electric field, of the magnetic field. Magnetic field is a space gradient, all at this point, okay? So you write explicitly the Einstein equations for this, And then, I mean, with the full geometry structure, you know, you have the full curvature terms and all that, except the curvature terms are not as. And then you prove that this thing matches uniquely to the E10 invariant. That is to say, there is a one-to-one correspondence if you identify things the way they are written. Where is it written? Yes. So the map between the two is the following. You find that what was an E10 parametrization for the GL10 part of E10 becomes linked to the metric in a certain frame. What was rather evidently the freeform object here is mapped to the freeform, but it's not the same freeform. I mean, this is a space-time freeform, and this was an E10 freeform. What is the sixth form here becomes mapped to the magnetic field, and here you have the duality which played a role, that is to say the explicit map between the two contains epsilon, okay? What is also very beautiful is that the nine-index object which was here is mapped to gravity in the sense that it is mapped to the structure constants, the spin connection of this thing. And this was not imposed a priori, it felt exactly as it is, and the equations of motion are the same. So we never have to match Lagrangians, for instance, with duality transformations. We work only at the level of equations of motion. All this works up to height 30, which means that it works for all combinations of roots, such that the sum of all the integers in front of the simple roots is 29 or less. And I am concluding. Now, so this was the fact. What could it be useful for? We were hoping that this could be useful in a kind of vacuum selection scenario in string cosmology, a la Horn-Moore, which would be the following idea. What we have found here is that in each corner of U-theory or whatever, we have found that the generic cosmological solution has a nice chaotic quantum billiard behavior in each corner. But now if we imagine that we look at solutions and states of string theory which are compactified in space, all sectors of string theory compactified in space should be connected by non-zero tunneling amplitudes, I mean transition amplitudes, and therefore we should imagine that the real billiard is not a separate quantum billiard for each string theory, but which be a quantum billiard which combines all those billiards, and therefore that there would be at the quantum level that the wave function of the universe would be like a quantum billiard in this thing superposed with quantum oscillations here. And we went even as far as saying, is there a Kac-Moody algebra which would combine all billiards we had before, because we had B10? And Victor Katz said that the only one was F20, which is this one. This is maybe a little bit too much. But anyway, this would be interesting.
But unless it combines all the
Yes, combining all five string theories. Because finally, all five string theories have only two separate billiards. Yeah, I forgot to say that we use all duality transformations to prove that the billiards, for instance, of all type 2A and type 2E are the same, and the type 1 and heterotic are the same, but they are different from the other ones. So there is E10 and B10. So I leave you read the conclusions about these things, because that's all. Okay.
We thank Thibault for a beautiful talk, and I want to add a personal commendation of not mentioning the anthropic principle even once during the talk. And please, Robert.
Paul Steinhardt mentioned in his talk that with the addition of brains, you could prevent chaotic behavior. Now, can you see that from your framework?
If you add, no, let's say the simpler answer is no.
I mean, does this fail at level 30, or you just haven't been able to go beyond level 30?
We haven't been able to go. At level 30, life gets more complicated. We seem to get maybe more degrees of freedom. The question is whether, here the naive view would be to say, the first elements of the E10 symmetry structure, they are linked to directly geometric objects or their gradients locally. Will this map remain local? That you don't really expect it remains local, okay? I mean, okay, if it remains local, then we should be able to identify all the elements and therefore all the roots in E10, in this infinite tower of E10, to more and more spatial gradients. What we were able to show is that all spatial gradients of supergravity fields are contained in E10. That is to say, we find infinite towers of E10 roots which correspond to all the gradients you can take of all supergravity fields, okay? But there are infinitely more things on the E10 side. And therefore, does it mean we are not really matching to supergravity only, but we should have more degrees of freedom there? Should we have like massive modes of the string? I mean, more degrees of freedom in string theory, not just the massless degree. We don't know. So we have a problem of matching the degrees of freedom.
You've left out the fermions.
We are now, with Fermat, looking at the fermions, which, as always, is a nice way of getting hold on the structure and the symmetry. But as there is no literature, we could get an E10 invariant thing, because finally our model, our coset model, is invariant under the adjoint representation of E10, and the adjoint representation of any group always exists. But now spinor type representation for these Kac-Moody things do not exist. Nobody knows how to classify representation. So to look at spinors does not help for the moment to guess what would be the structure.
So. Over there.
In this structure where BKL were interested in, it was near a singularity, where at the same time you can ignore the space derivatives, correspondingly higher time derivatives are enhanced. So do you imagine this structure will also help you control higher derivative corrections of some sort?
Yes, so I should say that evidently a famous historical objection to the analog of this work for 3+1 gravity by BKL, the objection of Dzieldowicz, was that this is nonsense because as soon as you get a few oscillations, you will go to the Planck time, and then you expect all higher corrections and quantum effects to take over, and therefore this is not a real thing. The hope here is that if we find really a symmetry structure, that maybe this symmetry structure would apply to the full string theory, including all its quantum aspects. Evidently, this is just a hope that it would give a handle precisely on all the higher order terms that you, even in an effective description, because they have to be 10 invariant. But this is just a hope. We should prove something first.
We'll take the last question. And
when we consider 11 dimension going to 4, the usual coset is E7 over SU8. And there the meaning of SU8 is very clear, and it explains everything about counting of degrees of freedom. And we
but
know
it's
we
a
have
local
SU8.
But it's a local SU8,
right.
Yeah.
What is the meaning of this group which you have in the coset? Is there any meaning to it?
We are, okay.
Because this has to do with degrees of freedom, as we know.
Yes, yes, yes. No, we are presently looking at that. That's why we look at the fermion sector where the SU8 is more evident to see. But the fact that all those representations are not mathematically existing for fermions is, I mean, we have to redo everything by hand. Formally, it's the only possible analog of, yes. In the Chevalier representation of the real form, it's uniquely defined, so it's very easy to write here.
So, let's thank again Thibault for his beautiful talk.